Your Honors, we've raised both procedural and substantive challenges to CMC's decision in this case. I'd like to focus first on the procedural issues, specifically the failure to provide meaningful notice of the specific nature of the allegation that resulted in discipline, and the absence of a process by which the fact finder could assess Jane's credibility. First, on the notice issue, the law is clear that a student accused of misconduct must be given notice of the theory upon which the discipline might be based and a meaningful opportunity to respond. And the nub of this case is whether that notice was given, when it was given, and whether it provided John with a meaningful opportunity to respond to the specific allegations against him. So clearly he got notice that there was a disciplinary proceeding pending. He got a letter from CMC advising of the date, the fact that there was a violation of the sexual misconduct policy, and the name of the complainant. But that clearly is not sufficient notice. That's exactly the notice that was given in the Doe versus USC case. This court had grave problems with this lack of specificity in that notice, that the student should have to parse through not only the conduct code, but through the night or the incident in question to try and determine how and if the student's conduct violated the provisions of the code. So that letter certainly wasn't sufficient. The first meaningful notice of the specific conduct that was at issue was in the preliminary investigative report that came out after the investigator had concluded all of her interviews, done follow-up interviews both with John and with Jane, and then issued a report describing Jane's allegations to John. Prior to that point, John was not apprised of the specificity of Jane's allegations.
When you mean specificity,
yes, Your Honor. Certainly John knew that there was an issue and concern about their sexual encounter on October 4th. And we can see from his interviews, he was defending against that the way that he understood the complaint to have been or might be, which is that this was the entire encounter was non-consensual, that Jane was intoxicated, and so forth. And so that's where John put his energies, that's where he focused his attentions, and then, of course, it became clear much later in the process that there was a specific portion of the encounter. Now Jane, there's sort of an arc of her allegations, but by the end, and when the school was digging in on whether we had misconduct, they were focused on the end of that encounter, the last, I shouldn't try and estimate how much time, but certainly the last part of a two-hour sexual encounter. And when John was interviewed, he did not know that that was the focus. And so as a result, in his interview, in a two-hour interview, in which he was asked about all the events leading up to the encounter itself, several months of interactions after the encounter, John, I won't say glossed over, because he certainly gave a description of this critical portion, but he didn't share sort of robust details about the word-for-word descriptions of how it was that they came to mutual consent on this one specific issue. And so he does say, he describes what his story is consistent throughout, but he doesn't give the detail. And that is that's the problem with the notice. That's where the prejudice is manifest. Because had John been aware of what the specifics of the allegation were, he could have focused his mind, his comments, his recollection on an event that had taken place months earlier and really sort of gotten to the heart of the issue, which he wasn't permitted to do. Now, where we see the manifestation of this is that the panel, when it eventually decided the case, held John's failure of recollection, or his failure of detail, well, it wasn't a failure of recollection, it was lack of detail, it held it against him. And that was one of, and I'll submit, and when we talk about substantial evidence, I'll talk about this more, that it was the only factor that was considered by the panel, that was articulated by the panel, I should say, that went to the actual issues in the case. So of the five factors that the panel articulated, only one of them really goes to this disputed issue, which is, did the parties consent to the unprotected sex? And on that issue, the panel found the articulated basis for its ruling was that John could not recall the specific words that were used in order to manifest consent in his initial interview.
Well, Let me.
I'm sorry. Please.
John had the opportunity after the preliminary report came out and availed himself of the opportunity to provide additional information to explain more to the investigator, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And he had, in the course of that opportunity, the ability to say, did he not, in my initial interviews, I was not focused on that portion of the encounter. It was not clear to me that that was the portion of the encounter that was of concern. And had I known that, I would have tried harder to recollect, but he had the opportunity to try and explain his failure of recollection, did he not?
Well, he did, and by that time, he had given, in a second and third interview, he had given more detail, and he did describe the conversation. But to the extent that in a sense, it was based on the panel's logic, he couldn't unring that bell. They were holding it against him that his initial comments on this were vague or incomplete. But on this issue of what opportunity John was given, and this goes, this sort of goes to this to the credibility cross-examination issue, he offered and asked to be interviewed again. That was declined. He asked that questions be put to Jane. That request was declined. He asked that certain witnesses be interviewed, and a critical witness, as noted in our papers, was not interviewed. So that was declined.
One was.
JB was not, and I don't know if it's a pseudonym in the paper, so JB works just fine, Your Honor. JB was not, but critically, Jane was not asked the questions that John posed regarding this issue. So when it's clear to him that this is an issue, John says, well, wait a second, there's some questions that should be asked of Jane on this, and the investigator declined to do it. Now, CMC in its brief here says, well, John had a chance to pose questions to Jane. Well, he did. We tried to, and that was denied. And as we've noted forcefully in the brief, the fact that not only did that not take place, but that Jane wasn't present for the hearing and was not questioned creates, it's really an insurmountable problem in terms of due process. And that is that the panel did not have an opportunity to resolve this credibility issue, which everyone recognized below meaning at the school level. Everyone recognized below, meaning the trial court level, but CMC takes the position now this was not a credibility contest. It absolutely, certainly was a credibility contest. Credibility contest meaning there were two versions of events as to what happened on this critical piece, on this critical portion of the encounter. John said that there was a mutual decision to engage in unprotected sex. Jane said there was not. That poses a classic, the court's cases of uses, he said, she said terminology, but it creates a classic credibility clash. And the panel knew, because the investigator told them, this is the issue we're going to have to focus on, both in the PIR, the preliminary report, and in the final report. The investigator said at the conclusion, that the credibility of the respective parties will be critical. And that was in the preliminary report and in the final report. In the final report, the last sentence of the final report says, telling the panel members, this is what we're going to have to focus on in this review meeting. Both parties offered explanations for their inconsistent conduct, which should be fully evaluated in the investigation, review, and findings meeting, which is what I'm referring to as the panel discussion.
Keying off your saying that the respondent said this wasn't a credibility determination, I think they do say it was a credibility determination, but they say there was, quote, corroborative evidence. I'd like you to address that also.
Well,
it wasn't, you know, it's not just that he said situation. You could address that also.
Yes, Your Honor. So the court did, not, excuse me, the panel did look beyond the statements to try to resolve the issue that they were ill-equipped to resolve because they didn't have the parties before them. So absolutely, they looked at corroborative evidence, trying to grapple with the issue of who's telling the truth on this. But ultimately, that was the question. Who's telling the truth on this? There were only two parties in the room, and they had diametrically opposed views or stories as to what happened with respect to this particular portion of the encounter. As I said, Jane's sort of her recitation of the events sort of shifted over time, but ultimately came to the point where it was a consensual encounter. There was consensual protected sex for an extended period of time, but in this final portion there was not. So the panel had to resolve this dispute. Now it can look to outside evidence, and it did, and it sort of grappled with the fact that that both parties were making inconsistent claims. They both made statements to their friends that they acknowledged were not accurate.
Or to doctors.
The text messages, John says he was sending pretextual text messages in order to elicit an exculpatory comment from Jane, which it did. Jane says she was telling her friends and doctors that it was no big deal because that was her way of coping with it. So the panel had to deal with this outside evidence, but ultimately get to the issue of who was telling the truth about what happened in those few minutes. So it's corroborative evidence in the sense that it's sort of second-tier evaluations of their credibility. And what could we look to in order to resolve this?
It's really
isn't consistent the better word than corroborate in terms of their argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
Because there was no one to corroborate because there were only two people there.
Correct. There's no videotape. It's documentary or extrinsic evidence that bears on the credibility is the way I would put it.
Mm-hmm. So I just want to make sure I understand your argument with respect to the lack of presence of Jane at the hearing. Are you saying that John should have had a right directly to cross-examine her, or are you saying that the committee should have had an opportunity to question her or to use his questions to question her?
The latter, Your Honor. We're not claiming a direct right. I think the court's been very clear that there is no such right. But the court has also been clear in Regents that in cases like this, where the credibility is critical and it comes down to a decision or to an evaluation of which party is telling the truth, then some form of
presence
and ability to assess credibility is crucial.
So you think the Sixth Circuit got it right in Cincinnati?
Absolutely, Your Honor, and it's consistent with Regents in California, and the Sixth Circuit, the facts are almost identical. The court cites Regents twice. The court articulates all of the same concerns that the courts in California have sort of addressed. The fact that there must be some kind of hearing, but it need not take on the formalities of a criminal trial, that education is the university's first priority, that the very nature of due process negates any concept of inflexible procedures universally applicable to every imaginable situation, the strong interest of colleges to eliminate sexual assault. I mean, all of the concerns that the California courts have wrestled with in Regents and in Doe versus USC, mm-hmm. Sixth Circuit is on the exact same path, and they confront this exact same situation. So, yes, we agree with that reasoning 100%.
Is it your position that the panel would be completely unable to evaluate credibility unless Jane was there?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, let me ask you a question. In domestic violence prosecutions, it is very often the case that the complaining witness comes to court and says it didn't happen. And at that point, the evaluation, the facts are laid out through a police officer who took a statement from the witness, putting aside confrontation clause issues because I don't want to go there with you. Juries evaluate the credibility of the complaining witness even though the complaining witness's only participation in the trial is to say it didn't happen and everything comes in through the police officer. Are you saying that juries are not able to properly evaluate credibility in that circumstance? And if they are, why can't the same thing happen here?
Your Honor, in the example the court gave, it's not a credibility determination in that case. The case isn't coming down to a credibility assessment. Because the police officer can testify about objective evidence that will answer the question, then the jury can evaluate whether that evidence is sufficient. So, for example...
Well, no, because the usually the defendant has either denied or does not testify, but the police officer is setting forth the victim's version of the facts. So what the jury has to evaluate is whether the victim's version of the facts is credible or not.
May I just add a point to that? The rationale of the Cincinnati case is that demeanor of the witness is important, and how someone answers a question, even in denial, is something that the prior fact should have an ability to observe.
Yes, Your Honor. And in Justice Allen's question, I think there is a way for a jury to do that under the scenario that you've described. The police officer presumably would describe the circumstances, the injuries, and the jury could decide whether that gives rise to a domestic violence
and
conviction.
Isn't that what the investigator does here?
Well, but the investigator doesn't and didn't have the opportunity. Well, the panel has to, the investigator teed up the issue and said, panel, you're going to need to decide who's telling the truth here. The CMC itself, in the appeal in this case, sort of chastised John and said, you're not understanding the role of the investigator here. The role of the investigator is not as the prosecutor. It's not as the leader of the panel. The investigator is just laying out the facts for the panel, and the panel is making these determinations.
But the investigator's on the panel.
Well,
the investigator has a vote.
Has a vote, but
and
not...
And the other two have to have data to make to vote.
Correct.
That's your point.
Correct. And that's also in their policies, that they sort of downplayed the role of the investigator in their own policies, as rightly so, and put aside whether it's appropriate at all for the investigator to also be on the panel. But having done that, they've gone to lengths to say, it's just one, she is just the person laying out the facts, it's up to the panel members, she being one of them, but the other two, to make a decision. And sort of to abdicate that and say, well, we're just going to go with what she said. And we don't know what she said, by the way. We don't know what Ms. Edwards said within the panel. We don't know if she, there's sort of an assertion in the pleadings that somehow she had sort of set them straight or showed them how to resolve the question. We don't know that that happened from the record, but if it did, it's not appropriate because of what this sort of three-judge panel, that's the point of it, that they objectively assess the credibility and the evidence. If I can just speak for a moment on the substantial evidence issue, on this, there's some tension here in CMC's position as to whether, now we're back to sort of whether it's a credibility issue. They say that Jane's testimony alone could constitute substantial evidence. And I would acknowledge that if Jane came in and testified and was subject to some measure of cross-examination and said, this is what happened, and the panel said, we believe her, then we'd have a very steep hill to climb on substantial evidence. But that's not what happened. And they can't have it both ways. They can't say, well, we didn't base the decision on Jane's testimony, but then sort of use that as a shield on the substantial evidence prong. Instead, what we're left with is the panel's articulation, the analytic route, as the Supreme Court of California has said, that we must follow. And the analytic route is that they couldn't resolve the credibility determination. They found that both parties were inconsistent, and so they looked to these five factors. And briefly, and we've discussed this in the pleadings, but briefly, of the five factors, four of them have nothing to do with the, or don't help to resolve the critical issue, I should say, something to do with it, but they don't help to resolve the critical issue. And the fifth is the one that I talked about earlier, which is the panel holding against John his lack of clarity or specificity in his first answer. So just very briefly, the first two points basically establish that the parties engaged in consensual sex, which is not disputed in this case. So the first one is that John left the room to get condoms from the resident advisor. Not a disputed fact, doesn't do anything to resolve the credibility determination that we need to resolve, or the disputed issue that we need to resolve. Second, both parties acknowledge that complainant performed oral sex on at least three separate occasions in order to maintain John's erection so they can continue to engage in protected sex. Again, doesn't go to the issue of whether there was unprotected sex. It only shows that the parties engaged in consensual sex. The fourth is John's comment that he didn't believe the complainant was super into it. That one's interesting in that John made that observation. That came from him. It should bolster his credibility that he was candid and forthright about that fact of the encounter.
I think he said more, that she was doing all the work.
And then he explained the basis for that concern. So to use, again, use those words, take those words out of context and use it against John is not, it doesn't satisfy substantial evidence. And the last one is John's sophomoric immature comment that he made to friends, which, inappropriate for sure, John apologized profusely to the panel and to indirectly to Jane, she wasn't there, but in his submission, that that was an inappropriate comment. But again, it doesn't go anywhere to resolve the issue of whether there was unprotected sex. So we're left with that, what is the third of the articulated factors, which is the one I talked about earlier, that John was not specific enough in his earlier interview, and that just highlights the prejudice of the process here and the fact that he was not given notice
and
before
your point
the interview.
Substantial evidence is we don't even get there if the procedure wasn't there.
That's right, Your Honor.
That is your point, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Unless the court has any questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Do you have any questions?
No, thank you.
Not at this time, thank you.
Thank you.
Reserve the remainder. Ms. Schoeffer, while you're getting ready, I made a mistake earlier. I'm going to call number 4 right after this, not number 2 right after this. So if you're on case number 4, Jarrett, I'm sorry. Boy, I can't read this quickly. If you're on case number 3, Mostafi, I'm calling you next, and then it'll be 2 and 4. Please forgive me. Go ahead, Ms. Schoeffer. I'm sorry.
No worries. Good morning. O'Melveny and Myers by Apollo Chopra on behalf of Claremont McKenna College. I would like to start with first principles. The United States Supreme Court acknowledged that when it came to issues of who is included or excluded from an educational institution, that courts defer to the educational institution, not only in its underlying decision, but also with respect to the process by which that decision is made. California courts have accepted that proposition of deference in the context of suspension, as in the case here, and expulsion of students from private colleges. It is also clear that when it comes to the issue of process associated with suspension and expulsion of students from private colleges, that due process does not apply.
You don't really make that argument in your papers. You don't really distinguish in your discussion of the case law between educational institutions that are public or private. I don't disagree generally with the proposition, but that isn't the argument you're making. And in the USC case, I think it was Justice Collins who said that the due process cases, the ones involving public universities, are, quote, instructive. But you don't, that is not the centerpiece of your argument.
I agree it's not the centerpiece.
Not
but
even
I agree it's
a
not
fork
the
on the table.
I raise it for the proposition that due process, as Pinsker in the California Supreme Court, makes clear that due process is not the standard. Instead, the standard comes from California Civil Code Section 1094.5 and common law interpretation of what that means. There are two standards that emanate from 1094.5, fair process and sufficiency of the evidence. And those are the issues that are animating the issue before the court today.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to start off with the issue of fair process. California courts have concluded that fair process requires two things, notice and an opportunity to respond. And I apologize because I will say that a lot because that does animate the issues before the court.
Well, that's what the USC court said, but I think the Regents Court said more than that. And the USC case was easy because there the accused had no idea what he was being accused of till the appellate process of the administrative. I mean, that was an easy case.
Right.
You know, so I don't you get much comfort out of that one.
I do think, though, however, the case in Regents helps us here, and I'll go through why.
Okay.
I'd like to start off with what courts, California courts, have made clear that is not required in this context. We know from Regents that a full dress hearing is not required. We know direct examination is not required. We know that active participation by attorneys is not required. We know indicia of criminal process is not required. And why? Because what these institutions are doing are adjudicating policy violations, not crimes, but policy violations. And courts make clear that in reviewing the processes that various colleges put together, that classrooms don't become courtrooms.
Well, but your esteemed adversary agrees with you on that. He's not asking for cross-examination by the accused against the accuser. You're talking about points that I don't think he disagrees with you. But what is the point he's making at us as a notice issue, and that without the accuser, let's call it Jane, being somehow present, whether remotely or physically, you couldn't have a fair process because the only issue here wasn't whether this is not a rape case in the sense that they were having sex according to her for 2 hours and according to him for 1 hour, consensually, not successfully, but consensually. And the last encounter was the one, her objection was not that they were having sex, but that it was unprotected sex, which under your client's policy is still a basis for violating school policy. I'm not saying you have to be raped to violate school policy. But. So I'd like you to focus on those arguments because you're talking about a lot of things that are not at issue here.
Well, I think, and I will get to notice right now, I think that that background animates the structure within which this court, this panel needs to make this
sort
decision.
Sort of, but Regents, the case you say helps you, was that doesn't have the issue we have here. She was present in Regents. There was an argument whether the panel could, no, there was argument that the accused could not see her behind the screen. There's no evidence that the panel couldn't see her. There's nothing in the opinion that says the panel was not able to assess her demeanor. So, and Regents, that's one point. So, you know, if you're trying to extract core principles, you have to see what the facts were that gave rise to them.
Agreed. And I can go there first rather than starting with notice of.
Disputing that your client did not have to have courtroom-like cross-examination by the accused against the accuser.
So I will address Regents and cross-examination now, and then I'll go back to the issue of notice.
Well, no, it's the presence of more than just cross-examination. It's where it's truly a he said she said situation, which this was.
I think the issue is to visually assess the witness and to listen to things like the timbre of one's voice, hesitation while answering, those types of things. Are what may require could require the presence of the witness either by video or behind a screen or visual, but within the sensory abilities of the judges.
So let's dig into that. The Claremont McKenna process is different from the process that UC San Diego used in Regents. The opportunity to respond in the UC San Diego process was in what is a live hearing setting. Claremont McKenna's process is different. Schools are entitled to have different processes. And how it is designed at Claremont McKenna is that the process by which both statements are tested happens in the investigatory process. With respect to the issue of face-to-face.
Ms. Chopra, mm-hmm. The problem is for me, and I think I'm echoing what Justice Bendix has said, we have three judges who are required to judge credibility, and the concern that I have is the lack of the ability to absorb sensory input by the two judges who were not present during the interviews. And there's no video, no behind a screen so that the person doesn't have to, so the witness does not have to look at the person which has been accused. That's the issue for me, okay? I'm kind of echoing what Justice Bendix is saying.
I'll address that directly.
And what the cases address.
Right. I'll address that directly. What the cases provide is notice and an opportunity to respond. In this case, credibility is one of the matters that is absolutely at issue. In this setting, credibility is first analyzed and tested in the investigation phase, and then you get to what is called the review committee. At the review committee, and this is absolutely in the policy, the two individuals who saw, so the entire panel saw John Doe. They did not see Jane Roe because in our policy, that is something that is not required. She'd already been interviewed four times below. The way that the process works is individuals are entitled to make an oral statement or not. Then they leave. And then the investigator presents her report in this case. At that point, questions can be asked by the two other panel members as to any issue, including credibility, so they have the benefit of the individual who has seen everyone face to face. But there are second...
Ms. Chopra, the problem that I'm having is I sat as a trial judge for 19 years before I went to the Court of Appeals. I've read a lot of declarations, something on paper. It's not live, and 94% of communication is nonverbal. So with something just on writing or somebody is reading something, you are missing, the listener is missing 94% of communication. That's number one. Number two, if the only perspective of the information that was gleaned by the investigator is through the investigator, then the other two judges are seeing things or hearing things through a screen, colored glasses. There's a filter somewhere along the way. And that is my concern. I can't speak for my fellow justices, but that's my concern. Okay? Just so we're clear.
Okay.
And that was the concern of the Sixth Circuit as well.
Right, which decided issues under due process, which is not the standard.
You say that, but you don't. That's not what you say in your papers. You don't make the distinction between a private and public university, and the cases you rely on say that the quote due process versus common law or fair procedure are instructive. As I said, that the argument saying there's a difference between fair process and what due process requires was barely a fork on your table.
I do think that we addressed, Your Honor, the distinction between common law and due process.
Yeah, you said it, but you didn't apply it.
So as applied here, I think that this, frankly, is very similar to the circumstance that Justice Zelon articulated. Just like the police officer who is standing up in the place of a domestic violence survivor.
Just one second. I know that Justice Zelon raised that, but the person the alleged victim is in the courtroom, you cannot go forward with that if it's just the police officer. So the victim is there in the courtroom. The victim may be saying, I see no evil, I hear no evil, I speak no evil, I don't know anything. Then the, in a way of a prior inconsistent statement, the police officer comes forward. The police officer also can say, I observed the person to be hysterical. I observed red marks on the face. I observed bruising. I observed bleeding from the mouth or the nose. So there's other things that go on with that. I know, so I'm having a problem with that example, at least as you seem to have taken it on.
But the investigator has the ability to do the same. And there is corroborating evidence.
Counsel,
in my example, the big difference between this and that is that the investigating officer then doesn't go into the jury room and vote on the outcome, does he?
That's correct.
And given the circumstances here, the investigator is playing two roles. One is, I'm going to gather the facts and I'm going to assess all the credibility. And the second is, I'm going to vote on credibility, which puts the other two members of the panel in a subordinate position, doesn't it?
They're potted plants for the credibility determination under your argument.
I disagree, and this is why. First, there is case law directly on point that allows a fact finder to also be a decision maker in these cases.
That's not the point. It's that if there's three people who have a vote, how can the other two vote if they can't assess credibility where that's the only issue here?
It's, with all due respect, Your Honor, it's not the only issue here, and they can
it
because
the
they
only
have.
It was the issue here.
They have the benefit of the investigator and her process and being able to question her, but they also have the benefit of other indicia.
Did the investigator, I can't remember this, in the report did the investigator take a position on who was credible or not? I'm not recalling that.
She identified that there were credibility issues on both sides.
So what's your point? If you're saying it's the investigator's determination, you know, it was making a credibility determination and she's a member of the panel, but she wasn't even making a credibility determination. She was lobbing the issue to the panel.
I think, Your Honor, that you can make a credibility determination in more than one way. I understand that perhaps it is optimal to have direct cross-examination. That is not required here. I know that Regents, we all know that Regents stands for the proposition that there must be, and what Regents says is a process through which indirect cross-examination is allowed. And in that case, it happened to be a live hearing process as opposed
present.
To...
It doesn't present the issue we have.
No, that's exactly right. Because what I think it is important, and that's exactly right, I think what's important in Regents is they didn't decide that indirect cross-examination before a panel was necessary. The live testimony before a panel was a fact, not a holding of Regents. And I think it's also important to examine the other elements of credibility determinations that one may use in this context. Because when you have a circumstance where two people have been inconsistent, very much the case here, there are other indicia that are perhaps more helpful on this record. And that includes consistency across statements or inconsistency.
They both were incredibly inconsistent in their behavior, in their comments, both fairly vulgar. His was more vulgar than hers. This did come down to whether you believed him or her, because both of them took actions and made statements that were inconsistent with the positions they were advocating in front of the panel.
I believe corroborating evidence makes a difference in this circumstance.
I don't even agree with the word corroborate. What's corroborating? There were only two witnesses there.
Well, what's
I don't even know what they're corroborating. You're saying that there's other evidence that would support, that's consistent with, pick a different expression. But it does boil down to whether the panel believed him or her. Because their subsequent actions were completely, were at odds, shall we say, with what they were advocating in front of the panel.
I think, though, if what you do is look at the decision as it was rendered, what the panel did is say, on this record, individuals are inconsistent. And so in order to render a decision, what we choose to do, and I think they're entitled to do, is focus on where they are consistent, where there was corroborating evidence, and how does that inform our decision.
You could have done the exact same thing looking at Jane's statements and Jane's activity and made it consistent with his position.
I don't...
You know, yes, you could.
So if you look at, and this kind of bleeds into the substantial evidence rule, I'm going to stay on process for a moment. But if you look at what occurred here, what you see is that as they were making decisions, they focused on, for instance, was there an agreement? This is an affirmative consent requirement. Was there an agreement to engage in unprotected sex? They looked at all of the evidence that was consistent between the parties to inform them and allow them to make an inference that the agreement here was protected self and protected sex. And whether that is the ability, the use of 10 condoms over 2 hours, that tends to suggest that the agreement was to have protected sex, not unprotected sex. That he got up in the middle of their encounter and he got more condoms. Again, an agreement for protected sex, not unprotected sex. She was injured. In her statement, she says he became rough and removed the condom. I said no, and he kept on going, and he was hurting me, and I tried to leave. There is ample evidence from the petitioner himself, where he admits that he saw that she was having difficulty walking, that he referred to himself, and pardon my language, as, you know, Bonehammer and Dickhammer, and again, pardon my language, that he fucked her so hard he put her in the hospital. There is ample evidence to support a conclusion based on the consistent information and corroborative information.
Your adversary said if the panel believed her, that's enough. Forget all the other stuff that in terms of substantial evidence. The problem is whether this was a fair process. That's what I see the problem in this case is. And I don't think that you're. Let me ask you one other question, because you started your argument by saying that this is an educational setting and we have to give deference. I was curious what you, I think maybe the appellant cited this case, and I have to go find it, the John A. case. What do you do with that case?
If you could,
let me get my facts right. I have to get all my cases out. That's John A. versus San Bernardino City Unified School District, 33 Cal 3rd, a Supreme Court case, 301. And they were interpreting, admittedly, a different an education code, and the requirement that in regarding evidence in an expulsion proceeding. And they said in that case that a reasonable person in the conduct of the serious affairs will not rely solely on written statements, but will demand the witnesses be produced so that their credibility may be tested and their testimony weighed against conflicting evidence. When their testimony appears readily available and there's no substantial reason why their testimony may not be produced. So even in an educational setting where expulsion is an issue, at least in that case, our Supreme Court has said, albeit there's an education code with its own requirements, has said that you can't just rely on written statements according to the lines of what Justice Cheney was discussing.
But
so
I
don't even think saying that education is special, you know, doesn't have, you know, has lesser procedures. I don't think the Supreme Court has supported that thought. And then you're saying this is the consequence here is just a matter of policy. No, it isn't. This is a serious it would be a besmirch his whole career, you know, both as a student and thereafter. And I think that the Regents case has also said that that the consequences of the finding of sexual misconduct, in that case it was a suspension, if I remember correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, was serious enough to implicate not just pure deference to the university. It has nothing to do with deference. It has to do with whether it was a fair procedure.
So I believe with respect to the case, if I'm thinking of the right case, and there was actually a more recent case, I think it's called.
There was a very recent case from the Michigan District Court, but I don't think it helps you.
No, actually not Michigan, from California. Okay. That was cited in the appeals, in the reply brief for the first time. But those are cases where the legislature has required the application of particular process to public schools K through 12. And there's a reason, because you have a constitutional right to that free education. But I think it's important insofar as the legislature has made affirmative consent a requirement. The legislature did not make that process applicable here. They could have. They have never chosen to do so. And I think that speaks volumes to the issue of deference and the ability of higher education to be able to develop processes that suit their purposes. And so I think actually those cases help us, especially in the state of California.
Well, in your view, who decides what makes a process fair, the court or the university?
I think what makes a process fair has been largely undefined through time, and it's through common law. It's through courts' decisions, kind of brick by brick by brick, interpreting what is fair is how this law has been kind of developed.
So the concept of deference does not apply to the determination of a fair process.
Excuse me for one second. You have 5 minutes left.
That I disagree with. The concept of deference does apply, and you see that concept run through Regents and USC. It is primarily, and frankly, you see it in Pinsker out of the California Supreme Court. It is for the institution in the first instance to develop the process, and it is to that courts defer if there is fairness. And I would submit to you on if you look at this process holistically, as opposed to in kind of the disaggregated fashion that petitioner has presented it to you, I think across the entire process, there is notice and opportunity to respond. And I want to quickly address notice, because I think that there can be no question that notice was provided here. First, if you look at the third interview directly, he has asked the question point blank, whether or not he had consensual sex, whether or not the unprotected sex was consensual. It was asked, it was answered, he knew exactly what he was answering to.
And he had lawyers at every step of the
process. Absolutely.
Process.
That's right. And he also got, and he admits this, notice through the preliminary investigation report. Again, what is required is notice before the decision. He admits he received full notice before the decision. And so what is left is, frankly, an interpretation of Regents and this right to indirect cross-examination. I would note for the record, because I do think that this is important, whether or not the panel had the benefit of seeing Jane Roe is not something that was briefed below. What was briefed below was the issue of cross-examination, and it was addressed below through argument around Claremont McKenna's policy with respect to the moment in time where cross-examination is allowed indirectly, and that is through the investigator. I think it's also important to note with respect to the questions asked, on cross-examination, your questions are only as good as the questions are. If you look at the questions, and Judge Strobel very carefully goes through them, what you see are questions that are redundant. The issues are already in the record. They are irrelevant or were asked in a way that was inconsistent with Claremont McKenna's policies with respect to prior sexual behavior. All of his questions were analyzed, and they weren't asked because they didn't advance the ball. So there is no prejudice with respect to the questions asked but not answered. That's directly addressed by Judge Strobel. And so that leaves us with a question that I think you're grappling with, which is whether or not in these informal processes you must essentially have a live hearing. And that is simply not required, as long as it's fair. And I would submit to you
Cincinnati court doesn't agree with you.
That's right, but that's...
And the other cases you rely on were presented with that issue because the person was there. Or the procedure was so non-existent, like in the USC case, that you never even got to that level of analysis. So, I mean, there was no notice in that case. He was told on appeal,
agreed.
Oh, here's our charge against you. Okay. I mean, that's not what we have here. I agree with you that in your response to your questions from my panel members here, that this is a matter of evolving law, and judges and justices have a role in that, apropos deference. And it's a very difficult issue because you're balancing the serious consequences against the accused, against wanting to encourage people to come forward
right.
and not be abused in a process when they've been a victim of misconduct. So it's a delicate balance, and you see the courts wrestling with this.
Ms. Chopra, do you have a response to that? Because your time is up. If you have a response to what Justice Van Dyck just said, please give it to us. Otherwise, your time is up.
I would say that in this case, it's balanced through the combination of the testing of the allegations and credibility determination in the investigation portion, and then how that is added to the review committee holistically.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
8 minutes, Mr. Harris.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to first address this issue of the deference and California schools being able to do what they need to do and not have the courts or interfere with that process. I argued the USC appeal, and the argument was made, and the court found that even though USC is a private university and these other cases are federal cases and so forth, that there is this common law fair procedure, right? And you can see in the opinion the court goes, and Justice Collins goes at some length about what that means and what that requires. After the appeal, all of the California private universities filed letters with the California Supreme Court to try and get the court to back away from that position and saying that the California private schools should have the right to do what they need to do, and the California Supreme Court denied rehearing in that case. So I do think that's an argument that's been made, and I think the USC case sort of addresses it and deals with it. This issue of what can be done or what process might be appropriate in order to address, to make it fair and address these sort of credibility assessments. Regents, counsel talked about the fact that was a live hearing. It doesn't have to be that way. But Regents says, the holding in Regents is that where findings are likely to turn on the credibility of the complainant and the respondent faces very serious consequences if he is found to have violated school rules, we determine that a fair procedure requires a process by which the respondent may question, even if indirectly, the complainant. So this idea of brick by brick and common law, well, there we have California Court of Appeals saying this is what's required in the case where credibility is at issue and the person faces severe consequences. The Regent Court went on after making that holding because, of course, the complainant was present and did answer questions. And 8 pages of analysis in the court's decision about whether particular questions needed to be asked, should be asked, or were redundant, and so forth. If it wasn't necessary or required that there be some meaningful cross-examination, what was the point of all that inquiry from the court, that sort of probing inquiry and analysis of whether how specific questions needed to be, when a panel can disregard a question and move on. But so what rises from that, what certainly comes out of that, is a crystal clear holding that we have to have at least some mechanism to try to, as Justice Chaney said, assess the demeanor, the credibility, and the body language and so forth of a critical witness when credibility is at issue, when it turns on credibility, and when the respondent faces very severe consequences. Another issue that came up in the argument is the role of the investigator, and counsel for CMC said several times that we have a model at CMC whereby the investigator does the nitty-gritty sort of credibility evaluations and then, I guess, sort of imports that into the panel process. And as the court has pointed out in its questioning, that doesn't quite do it because you've got these other two panel members. But CMC's own policy says that that's not what's supposed to happen. And I alluded to this earlier, but I want to give you the record site. At AR 416, in denying John's appeal, CMC wrote, some administrator at the university or the college wrote, talking about the role of the investigator, they are not advocates, not prosecutors. The investigator does not lead the investigation and review committee meeting, nor does the investigator draft the findings report. Each member of the committee has an equal vote. So CMC understood at the time, they've changed their policy, by the way, but at the time, that each committee member had a vote, and that each committee member presumably has to make the determination that Justice Chaney's talking about, or you've all talked about in your questioning, and that is to assess the credibility of the parties. So to sort of slough it off on this one party, we've got a potted plant situation, but B, it directly contrary to the school's policy on that very issue. There was an issue raised about John's questions, and counsel went through and described the mechanism by which the investigator or the CMC, I think it's at that point the Title IX coordinator, is deciding which questions should be asked. Those are not, just want to make clear, those are not questions of Jane. Those were further investigative steps that John asked for. And there was a litany, as you say, Justice Bendix, there were, I think at certain stages, lawyers involved. From the beginning, but then interestingly, at two of John's second and third interview, it's noted that there was not anybody present.
You weren't the lawyer.
Sorry?
If I remember correctly, your firm wasn't.
I was not. We were not involved, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. Regardless, there was, I don't know why I even allude to the fact that they're lawyers, but there were robust questions that were posed. Maybe John came up with them, maybe others, but not to Jane. Jane, there were two or three questions posed, and they're found in the record at page 10, AR 10, that go to the consent issue. And I believe the specific question was, it's something along the lines of, Jane is now raising the fact that the unprotected sex was not consensual. When is the first time she told anybody about that? Who did she discuss that with? Are there any documents or text messages that confirm that?
2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. So those are the questions that I was referring to earlier when, to the extent that CMC wants to sort of fall back, and I don't think it's sufficient because I do think this court needs to decide whether the overall process was fair, but to the extent they want to fall back on this notion that, well, we had a mechanism for questioning Jane, just not the one that Regent says you're supposed to have, but even that mechanism didn't follow through. So when questions were put in the investigation context, once John learned of the preliminary investigative report and he asked the questions to be put to Jane on the critical issue, which had only then sort of emerged, those questions were declined and they wouldn't ask them. And then, of course, we get to the hearing and we've been talking now for the last hour or so about what happened and didn't happen at that hearing. But I just wanted to clarify that issue. Unless the court has further questions, we'll submit.
There are no further questions. Thank you very much. This has been a fascinating argument. And I'd also like to tell Justice Zeilon, I'd like to thank you very much for coming and joining us this morning.
Thank you. It was a privilege.
The matter of Doe versus Claremont is submitted. And.